The Index Astartes, a history of the Space Marine Legions and subsequent chapters, where appropriate, up to the 13th Black Crusade.
The Ultramarines. Since the ancient times of the Great Crusade, the Ultramarines have fought at the forefront of the Emperor's armies. Highly disciplined and courageous warriors, the Ultramarines remain true to the teachings of the Holy Codex Astartes, the greatest work of their Primarch, Rabute Gilliman, for 10,000 years. Tales of their victories are told from their homeworld, Macragge, to the sacred halls of Terra. Whenever the enemies of mankind threaten the Imperium, the Ultramarines stand ready to fight them. Uniquely amongst the first founding legions, the history of the Ultramarines is relatively well documented, and there exists a wealth of information regarding the formation of this most illustrious chapter. One of the greatest mysteries concerning the Primarchs of the Space Marine Legions are the circumstances of their sundering from the Emperor, and this has vexed scholars down through the millennia. There are many wild and fanciful theories, but none can fully explain how such a calamitous event could be allowed to transpire. While it is a mystery that will probably never be solved, it is when Rabute Gilliman's discovery on Macragge is examined that Imperial scholars find perhaps the greatest clue to the true facts of the matter. Macragge is a rocky, inhospitable world on the eastern fringe of the galaxy. Three quarters of its surface is covered by bleak, mountainous uplands, the rest with glittering blue seas. Macragge had survived the worst catastrophes of the Age of Strife. Its industries had remained intact. Contact has remained with nearby star systems, and spacecraft regularly travelled between them. The people of Macragge were ruled by two kings, or consuls, and their word was law. To break their laws was to invite severe retribution, but honest toil was rewarded, and positions of power granted to those most capable. Life on Macragge was harsh, and only the strongest survived to adulthood. The state determined whether children, both male and female, were strong when they were born, and weakling infants were left on the mountains to perish. To be a citizen of Macragge was to live a life of discipline, self-denial, and simplicity. The people viewed themselves as the true inheritors of humanity's best traditions, shunning luxuries and occasion for leisure. Reliance on technological advancement was seen as bringing discord, weakness, and a decline in moral values. This exercised a profound pull on the surrounding systems, which admired the discipline and order of Macragge. To maintain this way of life, children of both sexes were sent to military and athletic academies at the age of 6, where they were taught to fight, build their stamina, and maintain discipline, endure extremes of pain, and survive in the wild. Life for the students was brutal, and only the very best survived. At 14, after 8 years of the toughest training imaginable, those students became soldiers. This punishing regime ensured that the military might of Macragge was second to none, and many of the surrounding systems adopted the same method of training. While the rest of the galaxy threatened to plunge back into the anarchy of the Age of Strife, Macragge and her neighbours prospered, disciplined armies of highly trained warriors hurling back alien invaders, pirates, and human renegades, time and time again. A soldier served until he or she reached the age of 30, when they were allowed to leave the military and start a family of their own. However, despite the overwhelming military successes off-planet, areas of Macragge remained untamed and wild, with bandits and brigands raiding from the barbarous islands of Illyrium in the north. Connor, the mightiest battle king of Macragge, had led armies against the northern barbarians, but even he had never managed to pacify the region for any length of time. The coming of Rabute Gilliman was a time of great omen for the people of Macragge. Scribes recorded many strange sights, and a passage in Connor's journals offers a significant clue to the mystery surrounding the Space Marine Primarchs. These writings have been preserved by the librarians of the Ultramarines, and its words have enlightened and divided Imperial historians in equal measure. Such dreams as might make a man believe he had lost his mind, or worse, fallen prey to a demon, beset me nightly. It had been 3 months since I spent a night not woken from sleep by a scream so terrible I scarce believe it to be my own. Every night, dark terrors of fang and claw seek to rend my flesh and feast on my soul. The physicians prepare me infusions of lassium root, but they do not help. Until tonight I felt like I should go mad, but as I dreamed of dark monsters that longed to suck the marrow from my bones, I beheld an armored figure in a molded breastplate of iron, embossed with an eagle and polished so that it shone like silver. A close-fitting helm of bronze obscured the warrior's face, and he stood with a wide-bladed sword that crackled with powerful energies. The dark beasts swarmed around him, but he smote them with his mighty weapon, and as each creature fell, it howled and vanished from sight. As the last beast was slain, the warrior turned to me, and I suddenly found myself beside Hera's Falls in the valley of Laponis. Spray from the mighty waterfall drenched me, and I saw a golden-haired child on the ground. The warrior bade me protect the child, and as I reached to gather the baby in my arms, I woke, feeling more refreshed than I have in months. Dream or vision, I do not know. But I awoke with a fine mist of fresh mountain water on my face. According to legend, the Valley of Laponis was the site of the crowning of the first Battle King of Macragg, and the following day, Connor rode east at the head of his bodyguard to Hera's Falls. Weeks later, the king's expedition eventually crested the impenetrable, snow-capped peaks and reached the vast falls, glacier waters thundering to the rocks tens of thousands of feet below. Here, wrapped in swaddling clothes, they discovered the child that Connor had seen in his vision. How the child came to be in the isolated valley was a mystery that would never be solved, but it was seen as a great omen that the child should be found in a place of such historical significance. Connor took the babe back to his palace and named him Rabute, which means Great One. Rabute grew quickly, as did his capacity for learning, and within the space of a few years, he had mastered everything the wisest men of Macragg could teach him. At the age of 6, as was the custom for children of Macragg, he was taken from his father and inducted into the Agacilius barracks, where he mastered the art of war with breathtaking speed. His grasp of philosophy, history, and science was greater than anyone alive, yet his true genius lay in the field of military organization. After 2 years, it became farcical for Rabute to remain at the training barracks, as he was already the mightiest warrior on Macragg. He could best every one of his instructors in hand-to-hand combat, and none could outthink his battlefield stratagems. As Rabute took his place within the military, Macragg itself was in a state of change. Connor was a well-liked ruler, yet his fellow consul, a vain and jealous man named Galen, plotted against him. In these times of prosperity, Galen and a powerful group of wealthy elites of Macragg had grown fat off the labour of slaves and vigorously opposed Connor's proposed reforms that would oblige them to provide their slaves with reasonable food and accommodation. Connor also pushed through legislation that forced the wealthy to contribute to his ambitious programme to enlarge and improve the capital city. His reforms were of great benefit to the people of Macragg, but Galan and his supporters were fearful of losing their wealth and power. Such was Rabute's fearsome reputation, Galan knew that he could not strike while Connor's son was still in the capital, and secretly arranged to have him removed from the city. Spreading gold amongst the Illyrium tribes, Galan had the tribesmen launch a series of bloody raids against the northern communities of Macragg. He then counseled Connor that the pacification of these tribes would be the perfect task for Rabute. Connor readily agreed. He had been seeking a task worthy of his son, and he believed that this was the perfect opportunity for him to prove his readiness for command. Rabute marched north into the untamed lands of Illyrium and launched a brilliant campaign against the tribesmen. His genius for military strategy and organization was nothing short of legendary, and within 2 months, his expeditionary force had not only pacified the entire region, but had earned the respect of the fierce tribesmen. Rabute became blood brother to Baradilis, headman of the strongest tribe, after sparing his life in battle and accepting oaths of loyalty from the leaders of every other tribe at the gathering of Paeonia. Bidilis then told Rabute of the gold that had come north from Galan and begun the bloodshed. Rabute immediately gathered his men to march south to the capital, but as they came within sight of the city, they saw thick pillars of black smoke and the flickering glow of many fires. Ribute led his army towards the gates, advancing through hordes of citizens fleeing from the terror within. The city was in anarchy. Drunken soldiers looting and killing at random, and fires raging unchecked. Ribute marched to the Senate House, executing any looters he came across, and formed work details to fight the fires that threatened to engulf the city. 100 soldiers in the pay of Galan blocked the gates of the Senate House, but Ribute butchered them and forced his way inside. Leaving his troops to deal with the drunken mob, he fought his way through the Senate building to find Connor lying near death, an assassin's blade lodged in his heart. With his dying breath, Connor told his son of Galan's betrayal and implored him to continue his works. The physicians did what they could for the Battle King, but the wound was poisoned and they could do nothing to save him. Ribute's thoughts filled with vengeance as he began the task of restoring order within the city. Those soldiers who remained faithful to Connor were besieged within their barracks, but when word reached them of Ribute's return, they broke out and linked with other forces loyal to the Battle King. With Ribute at their head, the rebels were soon crushed, and not a single man was spared the Primarch's wrath. Galan had fled the planet, but Ribute hunted him down and dragged him back to Macragge in chains, personally beheading him with Connor's sword. By popular demand, Ribute assumed the mantle of Battle King of Macragge, and he worked swiftly to destroy those who had betrayed his father, executing them and seizing their lands and titles. He distributed these amongst his loyal supporters and set about continuing his father's works. A year later, the rebellion was forgotten and Macragge flourished like never before. Soon, Macragge had been almost completely rebuilt with wondrous structures of smooth marble, steel and glass. The people prospered and wanted for nothing. Disciplined, well-equipped armies from Macragge kept the king's peace, and starships travelled regularly between neighbouring systems. It was, in all respects, a perfect model of human society, and when the Emperor learned of this utopian civilization, he took ship for Macragge to meet its legendary king. The Speculum Historiale records the meeting of the Emperor and Ribute Gilliman in great, and often unnecessary, detail, and many historians cite this as proof that the Emperor had set Ribute Gilliman on Macragge deliberately. The Emperor met Ribute wearing a polished silver breastplate with an eagle at its centre and an all-enclosing bronze helm. He carried a glowing power sword and welcomed Ribute as an equal. Ribute instantly recognised the Emperor from the description in his father's journal and knew that he had at last met his true father. The Emperor was astounded by the prosperity and strength of this world and immediately assigned the forward base of the Ultramarines Legion to Macragge. The Ultramarines had been created from Ribute's genetic template, and they established their base in the high Laponis Valley, beginning construction of a mighty fortress on the exact spot of Ribute's discovery. The Primarch soon assimilated the wonders of the Imperium and readily took command of the Ultramarines Legion. As ever, his greatest talents lay in the arts of war, and he led the Ultramarines to victory after victory, further expanding the Emperor's realm. He liberated countless worlds from the domination of aliens and foul chaos renegades. But where some of his brother Primarchs left a trail of death and destruction in their wake, Ribute brought peace and fresh prosperity. Every world the Ultramarines liberated rapidly took its place amongst those loyal to the Imperium, and Gilliman's genius for planning campaigns ensured that the planet's population and industry suffered the minimum amount of collateral damage. On Macragge, the Fortress of Hera took shape, a building of such magnificent proportions that it defied the human mind with its grandeur. Upon its completion, those Ultramarines who had remained behind to oversee its construction began recruiting from Macragge and the surrounding systems. The training academies provided many fine candidates for the Legion, and soon the Ultramarines received the first influx of warriors born and bred on Macragge. The surrounding systems also provided warriors for the Legion, and before long, the Ultramarines were the largest Legion in existence. When Horus turned against the Emperor and led the galaxy into the most destructive civil war it had ever seen, the Ultramarines were engaged deep in the galactic south. Their very successes had carried them far from Horus's armies in the northeast, and Gilliman did not receive word of the betrayal until the Battle for Terra was underway. Gathering his legions, Gilliman led his forces towards Terra, en route destroying a rebel fleet on its way to reinforce Horus. The war had been won by the time Gilliman's warriors reached Terra, but the Imperium was in turmoil. Half the Space Marine Legions had sided with Horus, and the remaining Loyalist legions had been badly mauled in the fighting. There were desperately few Space Marines, and never were they more needed. The enemies of mankind, sensing the weakness of the Imperium, prepared to attack. But Rebute Gilliman vowed that the Emperor's realm would not fall, and took it upon himself to hold it together. He dispatched his legion throughout the galaxy to stem the tide of invasion and unrest, holding the fragile Imperium together through a time of great danger. McCragg provided recruits as fast as it could, and soon the Ultramarines accounted for more than half of the Space Marines in the field. After almost a decade of total war, stability was restored to the galaxy, and the philosophies of the Ultramarines' way of war had permeated almost every legion. Under Gilliman's guidance, the holy Codex Astartes was taking shape, and its doctrines would shape every future Space Marine force and lay the foundations for the Imperium's conventional military might. The Codex Astartes laid down the tactical doctrines of the Imperium's fighting forces and was to grow and evolve over the millennia into a massive tome that detailed everything from battlefield stratagems to uniform markings for various squad types. The most immediate change was the decree that each legion would be split into smaller units known as chapters. One chapter would keep the name and heraldry of the original legion, whilst the remainder would take a new name and iconography. No longer would the power of an entire Space Marine legion rest in one man's hands. Some legions resisted this change and refused Gilliman's orders, but when the matter threatened to erupt into a new and bloodier civil war, they eventually relented. Most of the original legion split into five or less chapters, but the exact number created from the Ultramarines is uncertain. According to the oldest known copy of the Codex Astartes, the so-called Apocrypha of Scaros, the Ultramarines were split into 23 chapters, but it does not name them all. Rebute Gilliman continued to lead the Ultramarines for the next 100 years, until he and his warriors fought against the traitor Primarch Fulgrim and the Emperor's children on the world of Thessalia. Fulgrim had changed beyond all recognition. The noble man he had once been had died long ago upon his elevation to a demon prince of Slaanesh. And now, he was corrupt beyond words. His serpentine body was multi-armed, and each taloned fist carried an envenomed rapier. Billowing clouds of heady musk enveloped the Primarchs as they met in single combat on the red fields of Thessalia. None who were present on that day can say for sure what happened. Yet when the cloying musks cleared, the Emperor's children were gone, and Rebute Gilliman lay unmoving, a single bright slash of blood across his throat. Not even the Primarch's godlike physique could halt the spread of Fulgrim's poison, and as Gilliman died, the apothecaries set up a stasis field and transported their leader back to McCragg. To this day, Rebute Gilliman remains entombed within the stasis field, held immobile on his marble throne in the Temple of Correction on McCragg. There are those who claim that the Primarch's wounds are healing, but this is clearly impossible within the time-locked bubble of a stasis field. Despite this self-evident fact, many believe such tales and await the time when Gilliman will be fully recovered. Ancient Galatan, bearer of the banner of McCragg. During the 7-year Corinthian Crusade, in 698 M41, over 50 Imperial Guard regiments and detachments from 6 chapters of the Adeptus Astartes took part in the fighting to liberate the Corinth system from the domination of Orc warlord Skargar the Despoiler. In the final stages of the Crusade, the forces of Skargar had been pushed back to Corinth itself, and the Orcs had not been idle in augmenting its already fearsome defences. A heavy price in blood was sure to be exacted in its recapture. The Ultramarines were chosen to plan the siege, and within 3 months, Imperial forces had destroyed the outer defences, and Imperial Guard artillery pieces began shelling Corinth's main citadel. When a practicable breach had been established in the wall, a force led by Ancient Galatan, the bearer of the banner of McCragg, launched a final assault. Warlord Skargar himself led the defence of the breach, knowing that win or lose, the battle would soon be over. The fighting raged in the kilometre-wide breach for 9 days, with thousands of casualties on both sides. Each time the Imperial forces wavered, Galatan would raise the banner high and demand all men of valor to fight on. Inch by inch, the attackers climbed until, as the sun set in blood on the ninth day, Skargor and Galatan met in single combat in the midst of the breach. The warlord was enormous, even for an orc, and his strength was easily equal of a space marine. The greenskin's massive power claw severed Galatan's right arm, and the ultramarines roared in fury as they saw the banner topple. The warlord reached down to snap the banner pole, the crackling energies of the claw coruscating along its length. But this was an icon touched by the Emperor's own hand, and the warlord could not break it. Ancient Galatan reared up behind Skargor, driving his power sword through the orc's head and, seizing the banner in his remaining hand, raised it high once more. Again he led the charge up the breach, his superhuman powers of endurance carrying him ever onwards. Thrice more was he wounded, but his strength of will would not let him fall until the battle was won. As Imperial forces finally took the breach and millions of soldiers poured into the city, Galatan planted the banner atop the breach, slid slowly down the pole, and allowed himself to die. The Taking of Breach 2-4. In 999 M41, the taint of chaos was detected on the world of Thracia by Inquisitor Apollyon. The Imperial forces rapidly moved to meet the threat. Over half the planetary defense force had been corrupted, and worse still, there were reports that indicated the presence of Night Lord's Chaos Space Marines. Imperial forces drove the poorly armed traitors before them, until they were in a position to launch a full offensive against the capital city of Mercia. Before the assault could be launched, six bridges on the Imperial right flank needed to be destroyed in order to prevent the Emperor's forces from being attacked in the rear. These bridges were believed to be held by understrength PDF units, and detachments of Ultramarines were deployed via Thunderhawk gunship to capture and destroy each bridge with melter charges. Captain Idias of the 4th Company led the attack on Bridge 2-4, and, after a brief firefight, the bridge was captured. As Tech Marines rigged the bridges for detonation, shells began dropping in the midst of the Space Marines as a massive Chaos counterattack thrust towards the bridge. The main Imperial attack had been anticipated by the Night Lords, and now a considerable force was attacking the Ultramarines' position. The right flank of the Imperial Army was exposed, and Idias knew that he must not allow the forces of Chaos to cross. He pulled his men back across the bridge and signaled to the Thunderhawk as he prepared to detonate the breaching charges. The Ultramarines fell back in good order, but before the bridge could be destroyed, the Tech Marine carrying the detonators was obliterated by a direct hit from an artillery shell. As the Thunderhawk swept in behind the Ultramarines' position, concealed Hydra flak tanks blew it from the sky in a hail of high-explosive rounds. The Ultramarines occupied the bunker and gun nests at the end of the bridge and prepared to hold their position to the last man. Idias vox a warning to the Imperial Army and ordered another Thunderhawk to extract his men. For the rest of the night, the Servants of Chaos assaulted across the bridge and each time were repulsed by disciplined waves of bolter fire. Idias knew that they could not hold the bridge much longer and dispatched a raiding party to attempt to detonate the explosives manually. The attempt ended in failure, and none of these men were seen again until dawn. As the sun rose, Rhino APCs in the colours of the Night Lords pushed across the debris-strewn bridge. Ultramarines prisoners taken during the night were nailed to the hulls, their ribcages cracked open and spread wide. The attack was defeated, but there was no doubt there would be many more before the day was out. This is not the place to speak of the horrors the Night Lords visited upon the Ultramarines, but the traitor Space Marines utilized all manner of despicable tactics in order to undermine the discipline of the Ultramarines and break their resistance. Less than a fifth of the Ultramarines who had begun the operation were still alive, and Idias knew that one more push would see them defeated. He ignored the advice of his officers and set off alone in a suicidal attempt to blow the bridge himself. Idias managed to reach the first of the charges as the second Thunderhawk roared overhead, landing out of range of the enemy anti-aircraft tanks. Idias ordered the remaining Ultramarines to retreat under the command of veteran Sergeant Uriel Ventress, as the Night Lords began yet another assault. The surviving Ultramarines withdrew under fire to the Thunderhawk, and Idias waited until the last possible second before detonating the first charge. In a lethal chain reaction, the remaining charges exploded and destroyed Idias and the bridge in a searing blast. The Chaos attack across the bridge had been thwarted, and within 2 months, the planet had been brought back under Imperial control. Homeworld. The homeworlds of the Ultramarines are situated deep in the galactic southeast in the Ultima Segmentum, whereas most chapters have their fortress monastery on a single world. The Ultramarines control no fewer than 8 nearby systems. Collectively, these are known as Ultramar, and while each has its own government, armed forces, and individual cultures, all look to the Ultramarines and McCragg for leadership. The worlds surrounding McCragg are largely industrial in nature, and under Rabute Gilliman's guidance, these worlds were revolutionized into prosperous, productive planets where honest toil and virtue are rewarded. The inhabitants of these worlds are industrious, disciplined, and intensely loyal to the Ultramarines. When looking to their defenses, each world maintains its own dedicated armies, but can also call upon the protection of the Ultramarines. They are not required to levy troops for the Imperial Guard, but such is the prosperity and disciplined nature of Ultramar that hundreds of regiments stand ready to fight throughout the galaxy. As well as their own defense, the worlds of Ultramar provide recruits for the Ultramarines, and it is a source of fierce pride when a family can point to an ancestor who became a Space Marine. In the glory days of the Great Crusade, the world surrounding McCragg provided the Ultramarines with hundreds of new recruits, raw materials and supplies. This tradition has continued to the present day, and strong ties have been maintained between McCragg and its surrounding planets. Given the close-knit structure of Ultramar, it is not surprising that many of its worlds share a communality of language, culture, architecture, and governmental styles. McCragg is a rocky world, protected by numerous orbital batteries and 2 vast polar defense grids. It is here in the harsh and unforgiving mountains that the Ultramarines built the Fortress of Hera, housing the shrine of the Primarch himself within the Temple of Correction. Here, the Primarch's body is held within a stasis field, and the temple is a place of great pilgrimage for many loyal citizens of the Imperium. Talasar is a turbulent planet of tempests and violent seas, with but a single continent named Glaudor. In contrast, the free worlds of Quantern, Tarantus, and Massali orbit a common center of gravity, and outside the huge, enclosed agri-cities, the land is desolate and arid. Wind traps collect water for domed cities that protect verdant greenery and hundreds of square miles of agricultural land. Kalf's populace lives underground, far from the deadly rays of its blue sun, long ago seeded with poisons by the Word-Bearer's traitor legion. Vast underground caverns honeycomb the planet's crust, and though the planet is self-sufficient, like all others in Ultramar, a great deal of food is shipped in from nearby Ajax. The planet's shipyards are justly famous and construct a sizable proportion of ships in the Ultramarines' fleet, as well as those used by other arms of the Imperium. Both Ajax and Espandor are sparsely populated worlds towards the edge of Ultramar. Ajax is an agri-world and one of the most productive worlds in the Imperium, while Espandor is primarily composed of forests and rumored to have been settled when traders were blown off course by a warp storm during the Age of Strife. The crowning glory of Ultramar was once Prandium, and its natural beauty was famed throughout the Imperium. But the planet is now a barren, lifeless rock, stripped bare 250 years ago by the rapacious tyrannids of High Fleet Bearmoth. Combat Doctrine. As befits the chapter of Rabute Gilliman, the Ultramarines adhered rigidly to the tenets laid down in the Codex Astartes. For 10,000 years they have fought in the manner described in its holy pages. Other chapters may freely interpret the words of Gilliman, but to the Ultramarines such deviation is unthinkable. The Codex Astartes is a work of divine inspiration, sanctified by the Emperor himself, and the Ultramarines see no reason to deviate from its wisdom. The lifelong lessons of discipline and self-reliance that are taught to the people of Ultramar from birth give them the strength of character to hold true to teachings over 10,000 years old. For any given tactical situation, the Codex has hundreds of pages devoted to how it may be met and overcome. Each warrior of the chapter is required to memorize whole sections of the Codex so that within a company there exists an entire record of the Codex's tenets. The wisdom of thousands of Imperial warriors have contributed to the Codex, and details on everything from unit markings to launching a full-scale planetary assault are contained within its pages. Organization. Following the breakup of the Space Marine Legions into smaller fighting forces, Gilliman laid down the organizational diktats that would become a part of every chapter from then on, though some would later stray from the precise structure laid out in the Codex. Most chapters remain faithful to its teachings. The Ultramarines are split into 10 companies, each 100 Space Marines strong, and led by a captain. The first company consists of battle-hardened veterans, and is invariably the most powerful. It is also the only company capable of fielding warriors in Terminator armor. Following its complete destruction at the claws of Highfleet Behemoth, the Ultramarines' first company has slowly rebuilt its strength, and only now, 250 years later, has returned to full strength. Companies 2 to 5 are the battle companies, and these are composed of a mix of tactical, assault, and devastator squads. Each battle company is a self-sufficient battlefield unit, capable of meeting any threat and defeating it. These form the backbone of the chapter, and bear the brunt of the fighting. Companies 6 through 9 are the reserve companies, and each one comprises squads of one particular type. Companies 6 and 7 are tactical companies, 8 is the assault company, and 9 the devastator company. The 10th company is made up of scout squads, and the chapter's newest recruits. These divisions were decided upon 10,000 years ago by Reboot A. Gilliman, and have served the chapter well since that day. Beliefs. The harsh life on McCrag breeds hardy people with strong martial values and a hard-working nature. Discipline and self-reliance, as well as honour, are seen as cardinal virtues, and the children of Ultramar are taught these values from the earliest age. These are reinforced in the training academies, and by the time students graduate, they are amongst the most disciplined humans in the galaxy. The people of Ultramar are taught to respect the might of the Imperium, and to strive in its name is the highest form of service a person can render to the Emperor. As such, the workers and warriors of Ultramar are respected throughout the galaxy and are a byword for strength, courage, and honour. In battle, the Ultramarines follow the teachings of Reboot A. Gilliman, fighting with all the strength and ferocity of their legendary Primarch. An ancient saying of the Battle Kings of McCrag was that a warrior should return from battle either carrying his shield or carried lifeless upon it. And this is as true today as it was then. No warrior of Ultramar would bring shame on the chapter, and many are the deeds recorded by the librarians of heroic feats of bravery undertaken to uphold its honour. Gene Seed. The Horus Heresy highlighted weaknesses inherent in the Gene Seed of several Space Marine Legions, and this was exacerbated by the accelerated Zygote harvesting techniques used to keep the Legions up to full strength. When the Legions were broken down into chapters, a genetic repository was set up on Terra to store their Gene Seed and monitor its purity. As the largest Space Marine Legion, the Ultramarines' contributions to this resource are greater than any other Legion, and as a result, their Gene Seed became the stock type for many of the second founding chapters. Those chapters created from the Ultramarines' Gene Seed stored on Terra are known collectively as the Primogenitors or Firstborn, and they also venerate Reboot A. Gilliman as their founding father. The Ultramarines' Gene Seed is by far the purest stock, and there are no known aberrations in its genetic structure. Every one of the esoteric organs utilized in the arduous creation of a Space Marine by the Ultramarines are fully functional, and it can truly be said of this chapter that they are as perfect today as they were in the days of Gilliman himself. Battle Cry. Courage and honour. And there we go. The Ultramarines, the Smurfs themselves. I know a lot, they get a lot of grief, Ultramarines, and I think it's because they're like the newbie chapter that everybody sort of first paints, you know. I think most of us probably, if we painted a Space Marine, it was probably blue. But I think it's also that they're just, unless you know the lore and stuff, they come across as quite generic, and I think a lot of people ain't too keen on the lore and they're not fussed about it, they're just playing the game and stuff, or they haven't looked too deeply into it. But, you know, and as well, obviously, in the lore, they're very much as perfect as you're likely to get for a Space Marine force in the grim dark. I really like what they're doing now recently, particularly Guy Haley and a number of other people with the Dark Imperium sort of era we're in. Not talking about the Primaris, we'll leave that there. but the Primarch himself, Gilliman, what's going on with his sort of the politics and stuff that's going on with him and all that sort of stuff. It's really interesting, and it's nice to see that that's kind of rooted in his character from the very start, before the Horus Heresy was starting to be written. And we see that bound in there. He's very much like... it's drawing on a lot of like Greek history and Roman history, you know, and I like that. I like that. It can come across as sometimes a bit boring, a bit like just stale. Like, oh, he's so perfect. Oh, look at the Ultramarines; they're so badass. Look, everything's great. But when you look into it, it is really interesting. And you know, yeah, Gilliman's, I don't know, he is actually like a really cool character. It's just, I don't know. He's just too much of a good guy. Not that he is, but he just comes across that way. So, yeah, I don't know what I'm talking about now. I'm going to go. Ultramarines are all right, and particularly with the Heresy. It really filled out some of the gaps in the lore for me and made them way more interesting than they used to think they were. But they've always had that, you know, that, I mean, they're Romans. They're space Romans, you know, or with a little bit of Greek stuff in there. You know, they're that sort of archetypical... Empire builders, strong, reliable, courageous. We march from a crag and all that stuff. But there is like some good elements that have been brought in that show a sort of a darker and more deeper side to them, which matches well with some of the other legions, I think. They're not as boring as I thought they were going to be, or as I used to think they were, basically. Anyway, but I'll never collect them. I'm never going to have an Ultramarines army. Ew, that's disgusting. Ugh. Anyway, I'll see you later. Thanks very much for watching. Thank you to everybody supporting the channel. You can see your names here. And if you'd like to become a supporter as well, you can use the links below, various different options, or on YouTube itself as a member. And yes, I will. I'll be back again. I'm going to go, because I'm just rambling. I need to write these things out, don't I, really? Nah, I'll carry on doing what I'm doing. All right, bye.